Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Today on Wings, Philosophy and Gaslighting, a talk by Kate Mann.
The gaslighter, considered as an individual agent, is someone who cannot abide by disagreement. What makes the difference between the fellow who ignores or dismisses evidence versus the one who gaslights is the inability to tolerate even the possibility of challenge.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
My name is Aaron Wendland. I'm Vision Fellow in Public Philosophy at King's College London and a Senior Research Fellow at Massey College Toronto. And I'm honored to be hosting this benefit event for the Ukrainian Academy. The title of the conference is What Good is Philosophy? The Role of the Academy in a Time of Crisis. And it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Kate Mann. Kate is an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Cornell University. She has written two books, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, and entitled How Male Privilege Hurts Women. She is currently working on a third book called Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia. She regularly writes opinion pieces, essays, and reviews on moral and political topics for a wider audience, and her public work has been published in The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and Politico. The title of Kate's talk is Philosophy and Gaslighting, It's Not All in Your Mind. Kate, the floor is yours.
Thank you. A couple of years ago, I was privy via a friend to a discussion around hiring that had taken place in their philosophy department. Not mine, I assure you. Depressingly, it was an even higher ranking department. Some faculty members had expressed concern that their short list of candidates included only two women and eight men. Other faculty members pushed back against this worry. It's a meritocracy in philosophy. We want to hire the best person, regardless of gender, as if that would be what would be achieved via these gendered implicit biases. One man actually said out loud in front of his female colleagues, "We've gone the affirmative action route in the past, and it's been a disaster. Women in philosophy are just crazy." I was reminded of this incident recently by a depressingly similar anecdote recounted to me by another friend. Yes, these are just anecdotes, but the data, as well as personal experience, suggests these problems are systemic. Philosophy is not just white male dominated, it is systematically misogynistic, as well as racist, classist, ableist, transphobic, homophobic, and, as I've been arguing recently, fatphobic. So why do I stay in it? What is the point? It's depressing. The truth is, much as I think philosophy attracts a certain kind of person who uses the tools of the discipline to establish and maintain dominance, the status quo, etc., philosophy also has the power to help us push back against such people. More broadly, it can arm those of us who care to fight important battles for social justice. Of particular concern to me today, it can help us to combat gaslighting in the discipline and beyond it, and thus to combat attitudes like the ones that we saw betrayed by the man in my opening incident. It's an awkward social fact. Philosophy both contains numerous gaslighters, and it can help us to free ourselves of their influence. It can also make us more insightful about the ways in which we ourselves might unwittingly act in ways which gaslight others, or at least discourage their disagreement, and it can help us to do better. I want to begin here by introducing you to the basic original story of the gaslighter via the play Gaslight, sometimes also known as Angel Street, by Patrick Hamilton. Then I'll tell you my definition of gaslighting and highlight some features of the definition. I'll then draw on an insight of Kate Abramson's to explain the situation in philosophy as I see it, to do with the way that gaslighters are constitutionally allergic to the kind of healthy disagreement which we ought to be fostering and encouraging. So gaslighting takes its name from the 1938 Patrick Hamilton play, Angel Street, which was performed on stage as Gaslight. The play was subsequently made into two films by the latter name, both the US and UK version, and those films have become better known than the original play. But the play is, to my mind, richer than either film, so I want to use it as the basis for the discussion here, a discussion in which I draw on my 2020 book entitled How Male Privilege Hurts Women, specifically Chapter 8. In Gaslight, as I'm referring to it, Mr. Manningham appears to be intent on sending his wife, Bella, insane. His original motives for doing so only become apparent during the end of the first act of the play, but importantly, his behavior is intelligible right from the beginning, lending the play its claustrophobic, indeed suffocating, atmosphere. Act one is a vivid depiction of domestic terror. Mr. Manningham wrong-foots and undermines his wife at every turn, humiliating her in front of their servant, correcting her constantly, and even impugning the anxiety he is thereby instilling in her as irrational and baseless. There's a moment where he says, "Why are you so apprehensive, Bella? I was not about to reproach you." And Bella replies, "No, dear, I know you weren't." He goes on to reproach, indeed berate her shortly thereafter. In a particularly cruel and long-running series of manipulations, Mr. Manningham has led his wife to believe that she's going out of her mind and losing possession of her rational faculties by regularly hiding their possessions around their home and then holding her responsible for their disappearance. And he holds her responsible not merely causally, but morally, depicting her as mischievous and wicked, as well as confused and delusional. He also accuses her most painfully of all of deliberately hurting their pet dog, thus painting her as the cruel and abusive one. She actually loves the dog dearly and would never do anything to hurt her pet. Now, the combination of accusations at stake here is, of course, incoherent, as Bella Manningham actually tries repeatedly to point out to her husband. If she really was confused and delusional and couldn't help her behavior, then surely he should be trying to help her and treating her kindly rather than getting angry. But Mr. Manningham ignores all of his wife's attempts to prevail upon his goodwill. She's truly powerless within her household, and she is nobody outside of it, since Mr. Manningham has deliberately isolated her from all of her friends and relatives. So she has no choice but to defer to him, and even then it does little to appease his seething temper. The effect of Mr. Manningham's behavior, a devastating portrait of a recognizable pattern of abuse, which subsequently came to be known as gaslighting, is to deprive Bella of her sense of entitlement to state even the most basic realities. Towards the end of Act One, in an arguably disappointing deus ex machina, a detective comes to visit her and tells her this terrible, albeit liberating, truth. Her husband, Mr. Manningham, is actually the diabolical Sidney Power, who murdered the former resident of their home, Alice Barlow, in order to steal the famous Barlow rubies. Mr. Manningham, aka Sidney Power, slit Barlow's throat to silence her some 15 years prior. But he may never have managed to locate the rubies, which is why he persuaded Bella to buy this house with her family money. And the detective has come to the conclusion that he is still looking for the jewels on the top floor of the house, which is shut up and off limits to everyone but him, even the servant. So this detective, Ruff, confides in Bella, might he be looking for the jewels upstairs in this attic, this shut up attic, every evening? He might indeed, Bella realizes. Bella says, "It all sounds so incredible when I'm alone at night, but I get the idea that somebody's walking about up there. At night when my husband's out, I hear noises from my bedroom, but I'm too afraid to go up." The detective asks, "Have you told your husband this?" And Bella says, "No, I'm afraid to." He gets angry. He says, "I imagine things which don't exist." Detective Ruff asks, It never struck you, did it, that it might be your own husband walking about up there? Bella Manningham says, yes, that is what I thought, but I thought I must be mad. Tell me how you know. Detective says, tell me how you knew, Mrs. Manningham. Bella says, it's true, it's true. I knew it. Notice the epistemic language here. So Bella did indeed know deep down that her husband was creeping about upstairs because, and this is where the term gaslighting comes from, 10 minutes after her husband went out every evening, ostensibly outside, the gaslight in her bedroom would ebb. And 10 minutes before he came back, it would return to its former full flame. Now, what that meant in Victorian England was that the gaslight was ebbing because another light had been switched on, then off again somewhere else in the house. And Bella Manningham realized it could only be happening in the attic where this other gaslight must have been turned on, siphoning pressure away from the light in her bedroom. So you see, it's kind of a complicated and much subtler setup than in the film, where the husband actually denies the wife's perception of the gaslight flickering. Here, Bella Manningham was forced to deny and could barely admit to herself what she actually knew. Her husband's epistemic domination over her was so total that she didn't dare to question his movements, let alone his motives. His sense of entitlement was so great to maintain this dominant narrative that she was the one who felt guilty for entertaining even the slightest doubts about her scurrilous, lying husband. From the very beginning of the play, exchanges like the following show how little latitude she has to question either the rightness of his beliefs or the benevolence of his actions. In Act One, she ventures hopefully, "Oh, Jack, dear, you have been so much kinder lately. Is it possible you're beginning to see my point of view?" Mr. Manningham replies, "I don't know that I ever differed from it, did I, Bella?" "Oh, Jack, dear, it's true," says Bella Manningham. So in the context of the action as a whole, it's clear she's not allowed to question his kindness, a particular cruelty. And she doesn't even bring up the gaslight's flickering because she knows it would lead to rage on his part.
On Wings, you're listening to Philosophy and Gaslighting. It's Not All in Your Mind, a talk by philosopher Kate Mann for the series What Good is Philosophy? It was organized by Aaron Wendland and hosted by the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy as a fundraiser for the Ukrainian Academy.
So let's back up here and now do some philosophy. I've argued based on real life cases that gaslighting should be understood as a systematic process that makes someone feel defective in some way, morally, rationally, or even health-wise. For mental states like beliefs, desires, intentions, bodily states, and so on, to which they are in reality entitled. So this definition is partly my attempt to make sense of the fact that gaslighting may but need not be intentional. Notice that we don't require even an agent in order to make this definition of gaslighting work. Gaslighting may but need not involve this individual agent who is trying to harm us, as in the paradigm cases. And this makes sense of the fact that, as the philosopher Elena Ruiz has insightfully argued, gaslighting can also be perpetrated against people by whole collectives and practices and institutions, and thus constitute a purely structural phenomenon in some cases. For example, one perpetrated by white supremacy and the associated colonialist practices against people of color. Okay. But nonetheless, this definition still makes sense of the fact that some individuals do gaslight. And we can now ask an obvious question, why do individuals do this exactly? And here I want to draw on an insight of Kate Abramson's, who offers, I think, a brilliant answer to this question. In her view, the gaslighter, considered as an individual agent, is someone who cannot abide by disagreement. He is not just anxious about, but almost allergic to, being successfully contradicted. Other points of view, other perspectives are verboten to him. They're anathema to him. You see why I included that quote about Bella wondering whether her husband might be beginning to see her point of view, because that's exactly what the gaslighter shuts down, as he does indeed in that exchange, by saying, "We never differed." To quote Kate Abramson on this phenomenon of this kind of allergy to disagreement, what makes a difference between the fellow who ignores or dismisses evidence that his desires cannot be satisfied versus the one who gaslights is the inability to tolerate even the possibility of challenge, end quote. Okay, and this is from her 2014 piece in Phil Perspectives, Turning Up the Lights on Gaslighting. But we should reflect that the gaslighter is someone who can't tolerate challenges in a particular way. He doesn't simply kill his victim, which would be another surefire way of preventing her from challenging him, as Abramson also points out. Unless you object here that he may have some kind of compunction about murder, reflect that our paradigm case of a gaslighter is someone who is also a murderer, albeit with respect to different targets and victims. And this is also true, by the way, in many real life cases. In the most extreme cases of gaslighting, people willing to murder others. But when it comes to the target of the gaslighting, this won't work, this eliminating someone's perspective by eliminating them. Because the gaslighter wants to maintain the appearance, the illusion of an ongoing conversation, a dialectic, and a subject who is capable of disagreeing with him. And he wants to invariably win the argument or forestall it in the first place, making for a series of Pyrrhic victories. He wants to set things up so that he will get to feel like he has prevailed, even though in reality he set things up so that the victim really doesn't dare to question him. I was reminded when I was thinking about this of a quote of Donald Trump's in the lead up to the 2016 election. He said, "We're going to win so much, we're going to get sick and tired of winning," a kind of inadvertent stroke of brilliance via his usual malapropism and cliche strategy. Okay, so to get back to the kind of issue of how philosophy might be attracted to people who gaslight, might in fact attract gaslighting types, even represent at its worst a culture of gaslighting, you get to kind of imply in philosophy at particular points that it's not just that other people are wrong, it's that they're irrational or crazy. They're missing something obvious. They're reasoning poorly or even displaying poor moral character in as much as they take a different view, a different perspective. They are oversensitive, or they're too woke, or they're just not talented enough to see the truth. This is a direct quote that I've heard in the context of philosophers trying to establish dominance over other people in the room. Or insert any other summarily dismissive and monolithic intellectual character assessment of the kind that is acceptable in philosophy and in very few other disciplines. So I think that this is gaslighting, or at least channels the spirit that gaslighting exemplifies by shutting down healthy disagreement. I'm guessing this dynamic will be familiar to many people in the audience. But here's the good news. Philosophy is a discipline which prides itself not only on being a paradigmatically rational enterprise, just something I could do without, to be honest, especially when we're doing so to compare ourselves flatteringly to other humanities disciplines. But more positively, philosophy is also one that encourages everyone to ask questions and to push back against almost anything and almost anyone for almost any reason. So I think philosophy actually has the tools and the power, not just to provide us with important, conceptual wherewithal here, but also just as importantly, the social wherewithal to challenge gaslighting inside and outside of the discipline. It can make us able to say, "No, wait on, that actually doesn't sound right to me. And is that really irrational or crazy to think or to do? Or is it in fact an important challenge to a prevailing and powerful orthodoxy?" That's something we can do in philosophy. And in fact, it is socially sometimes encouraged in our discipline. So I want to be clear here. Am I saying that we need to be open to any argument whatsoever? Not quite. I think that would be too simple. There are arguments and views which strike me as genuinely beyond the pale for a simple principled reason, and one which indeed resonates with the goal of having a gaslighting resistant or anti-gaslighting philosophical practice. I think there are views which say effectively that some people do not deserve to be heard, either explicitly or implicitly, for example, by denying their humanity or their obviously authoritative lived experience and their testimony about who they are or what they go through in the world. I think both trans people and disabled people are often subject to these forms of pernicious denial in philosophy, and it in fact has much to do with the way some people are gaslit. It has the same effect as gaslighting in systematically keeping certain voices and perspectives out of the conversation. We've seen this might be achieved in other cases in very concrete material ways by calling female philosophers crazy as a rationale for not hiring us. So the general principle I'm gesturing towards, and I think this will be too simple for a bunch of reasons, but it's like just a first pass attempt. It might go something like this. We should be open to any disagreement and count it as a valid one, in as much as it doesn't systematically exclude or prevent some people from entering into disagreements because of their social identities. Here's like a very rough analogy to kind of motivate thinking along these lines. Perhaps we should be prepared to democratically deliberate or vote about any matter, except taking the vote away from some subjects within a deliberative democracy on the basis of who they are as subjects. So it's something like that structure. How then, I think the question remains practically, do we do philosophy in this kind of anti-gaslighting, gaslighting resistant, or broadly democratic spirit? How do we take firm stands ourselves sometimes, as I have myself here today, without unwittingly encouraging others to fall into line, or even perhaps gaslighting them unintentionally if we have some form of authority over them? So I won't pretend this is an easy task, but I think it is at least possible. Think about what we do when we're teaching, for example. I think we find ourselves regularly capable of defending a certain position which we may sometimes truly believe in. We don't always play devil's advocate in the classroom. But we do so in a way, I hope, that allows and indeed invites intelligent, respectful disagreement from our students. We hold forth and we are perhaps passionate about the views we defend, but then we listen. And we may or may not adjust our views going forward. We may or may not even be open to doing so, but we are open to others' dissent. Our practice is geared towards making space for it in an ongoing conversation. More broadly, we regard some disagreements as one we do have a stake in, but nevertheless do not want to win in the sense of convincing everyone else that they are necessarily mistaken. Rather, I think we can sometimes regard fruitful, intelligent disagreement, not convergence, as the epistemic gold standard and the aim of the exercise. And we can regard ourselves as one epistemic community member among others who does not want to prevail, again, necessarily. We want to be a part of an ongoing and historical conversation and to play our small part in it. Perhaps at its best, the philosophical community can be like this, and hence inviting to everyone rather than dismissing some historically excluded people as crazy or similar. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kate. I really enjoyed the talk. If I understand this right, the gaslighter can't tolerate challenges. And this happens in philosophy where people dismiss other people as irrational or offering poor arguments or something to that effect. But I take it you don't want to throw reason away completely.
I think it's all in the way we kind of wield not so much the tools of rationality, which I have no problem with, but really the rhetoric of rationality is tricky. Mm-hmm. So I think one way to do it well is to say, look, here's how I see things using the rational tools at my disposal. And this may be a subject where rational minds can disagree. I think that's often a surprisingly useful phrase to make it clear that this is controversial, this is tricky, and I might have missed something. I actually find myself using that phrase in the classroom where you can see that very intelligent, learned, and thoughtful people have gone different ways based on different lines of reasoning and ended up with opposite or at least mutually exclusive conclusions.
Good, that's helpful. If there are these sort of gaslighting tendencies within philosophy, you raise the question why you continue to do philosophy.
Yeah, this is very much linked to the talk, and I'm so glad for the question. Again, I think about teaching, and a lot of my students come from a group that has been marginalized or oppressed or excluded in some way. I pride myself as someone who I think attracts students who are coming from non-traditional philosophical backgrounds, as in they're not white men necessarily, although I have wonderful white male students too, hashtag not all men, blah, blah, blah. But I think disagreement is actually a little bit socially frowned upon for a lot of historically excluded people. Even just as a woman, you're often not really entitled in ordinary conversation to just say things like, I think that's false. Here's a counterexample, or here's an argument that that conclusion isn't true. Whereas philosophy actively encourages that because we have this kind of robust practice of, at its best, really encouraging and fostering disagreement. I think it can be an amazing way to empower people who historically would be a little bit socially on the outs if they just said, no, I think this is false. And it can create a space where that is possible and encouraged and socially sanctioned. Indeed, philosophy can be a difficult practice for historically excluded people who need to be supported to feel comfortable doing that kind of robust disagreeing and directly challenging authority figures, including, you know, old dead white guys like Plato and Aristotle. But when people really do get into the spirit of anyone can be challenged, again, for almost any reason, bearing in mind there are cases where it would be, I do think, horrible to challenge certain views that come directly from people's humanity or lived experience. But absent that, you kind of get to think what you want. And that is a liberating practice. Mm-hmm. So parts of philosophy that are good and bad, they're not really separable. There's room for someone to say that's false in a domineering spirit, which, given the overall context and the other things that they say and the overall power dynamics and the overall rhetoric they use, can establish this sense like, oh, you can't contradict blah, blah, blah's view about blah, blah, blah. That's the correct view. But it can also lead to a situation where people who are quite low down pernicious social hierarchies get to say that's false to the most socially powerful people. And they might well be right if they're sufficiently thoughtful and reasoning well.
Kate Mann, spelled M-A-N-N-E, is an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University. Her interests include moral philosophy, meta-ethics and moral psychology, feminist philosophy, and social philosophy. She also writes for mainstream media. Her books are titled Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, and entitled How Male Privilege Hurts Women. A third book, Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia, is due out in 2024, and she has a Substack newsletter titled More to Hate. Philosopher Aaron Wendland hosted this event, and the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy shared the audio. Their entire series, What Good is Philosophy, can be viewed on YouTube, along with links to support the Ukrainian Academy. As always, Wings thanks your community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose recent events can be watched and attended through the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. Our email is wings@wings.org. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support at sfu.ca.